Okay, people, we're on the air. I thought it might be a good follow-up in our social studies workshops of the last meeting. Thank you. To have a lady, I won't send mine back.
It's not too bad. You drink it.
Have a somewhat systematic presentation of our intercultural philosophy. And when I say systematic, I have to laugh because I've been trying to scramble together my thoughts in the last 2 minutes here. But I think that we need to begin, of course, with the down at the very foundation. The fact that this school was started during the war period and the New Deal period as a school with an intercultural philosophy. And this has been one of the important aspects of the school from the very beginning. And that an intercultural philosophy that's meaningful has to be built right into the structure of the school. It can't be just something that's in the classroom or that's in the heads of the teachers. It has to be practiced all the way through the school. And so that it begins with the nature of the school. And it ends when a school ceases to have such a philosophy in terms of its student body, in terms of its staff, and in terms of the basic makeup of the school. The building of a curriculum and a philosophy begins with the staff, and begins with the staff's understanding of the nature of prejudice in our society. And it can be developed in staff meetings like this, where we have very frank and open discussions, where we bring our problems and try to relate the daily living of the class to our theory. And that we look at the social and the psychological aspects of this question. We've not only had staff meetings, but we have also had parent workshops. So that on the parent level, we have had discussions, intercultural discussions, so that the kind of thing we're trying to do in the classroom is carried out in terms of the family. Now, I think that we have to be realistic. We have to know that a parent body and a school is a changing thing. That many of our parents come to the school not because it's an intercultural school. That we have on our in our parent body perhaps every gamut reflects every facet of American thought, all the way from prejudice to non-prejudice. And if they enroll in the school, naturally, the prejudices may not be so openly expressed. But I, when we find this in the school, I think that this is something that we should feel satisfied about, because it means that we are reaching people and that we do have an opportunity to change people. I have several important calls coming through this afternoon. I'd like to go back to some of the workshops that we've had in the staff in the past to give you some idea of some of the thinking that has gone on. Naturally, each year we have a certain amount of discussion, and there is change on the staff, and the experience which accumulates at one time doesn't get carried over. I have here a whole folder of material that's waiting to be pulled together into an article, and when that happens, material that of this kind can be presented to people, and they can get some of the previous thinking and activity in the school without having to be caught up in this way. And I'm deliberately taking some time today to do some of this background catching up, so that we can go on, because I know that in every classroom there have been situations that you would like to discuss. Some years ago we had some workshops on the situations that arise in an interracial school, and we had teachers from week to week write up any anecdotes. They were sent in, they were sent in advance to Dr. Gould, and then we had discussions, and discussed the implications of these little anecdotes. And I'm going to read a few of them to you so that you can get the idea of what we were doing at that time. Whole thing, these mainly were taken from the nursery school, and they represent what the teachers were looking for at that particular time was any indication of children's recognition of differences. The teachers watched for that particular thing. And here are some of the anecdotes. Daniel, lying on his cot, looked intently at the teacher. Miss Kennedy, who is sitting next to his cot and reading the story to the group, sits up and touches the teacher's arm to get her attention and asks, "Do Negroes turn white?" When the teacher asks what he said, he repeats the question. Teacher answers, "No, they don't, Danny." Teacher looked at him momentarily, waiting for further questions. Danny, however, smiling broadly at the teacher, lay back on his cot with his arms folded back under his head, looking at the teacher, still smiling. Suddenly he jumped up, looked at his arm, and said, "I'm white, huh?" Teacher answered, "Yes, you are." He laid it down again, arms tucked under his head, smiling and listening to the story as teacher reads. Of course, that's just a very simple little incident, and any of these incidents we would stop and discuss, see what the implication was, and so on and so forth. Another incident, this was again Minnie Kennedy. Pablo, holding a can in his hand, looking for caterpillars, runs over to teacher and asks, "Where is that black-faced boy?" This was, this I believe was in the kindergarten. Teacher asks, "What boy?" Pablo replies, "That boy, the one who has black over his face." Teacher asks, "What is his name?" Pablo, looking confused, runs away without replying. About 2 minutes later, Michael, a Negro boy, comes out of the door into the yard. Pablo runs over to Michael, says something which the teacher doesn't hear, and two of them walk off together looking for caterpillars. I think that maybe we might just stop for a minute and discuss these as we go along. And perhaps as we discuss them then, perhaps we might just discuss them now and see.
I think only it is important to point out that this particular
from the fact that we wanted. Before that, I remember there were a couple of incidents where a teacher or a parent felt very good. I think in one case, there were a couple of cases, but one case especially I remember, where a parent came to me very proudly and said, Peter's been coming home and talking about a new boy in the class. And when this parent finally got to the class and saw the boy, she was surprised to find that this was a Negro boy. And Peter had never mentioned the fact in all the stories about this little boy that he was Negro. And she felt that Peter didn't even realize this. And she thought this was a very good thing. And I remember at the time we questioned, there were a couple of incidents like that. And we questioned that. We felt we wanted children to realize that there were differences, and yet that we, and likenesses, but yet that people are different, children are different in some ways, and yet we like them for the differences, and we're happy that there are differences.
And when we started treating of these anecdotes, we found that the first thing that we began to realize that we always asked was, what did the child mean? Because we found that there are some incidents here which show this, that adults have a tendency to jump to conclusions about the meaning of a situation. For instance, if a very young child who does not happen to have been infected with any of the emotional feelings or prejudices and so on, and becomes aware that there are racial differences in the world, that this awareness may be expressed in ways that, say, a child later in life, if they use the same word, might mean something quite different, like this, where is that black-faced boy? Now, this may have been just a designation. It may, and then again, it may not. But before the adult reaches a conclusion, it's important to try to figure out what a child means. I know that there's some very interesting situations in the fourth grade with some of these new girls, with the Adair girls in relation to prejudice and so on, where one...
Sure, it's not just a designation.
What's that? Sure. Where it is not just a designation, but where... The prejudice is there, but it's also mixed up with a lot of other things. It's not just simply that, but it's a particular home situation. It's a particular way in which two children were brought up. It's the fact that they're twins. It's a number of factors of which prejudice is definitely one. But I think that this is a good situation to make that point exactly, that when you handle these things, you have to be aware of the fact that there are a variety of factors, and you have to look at the situation and see what it means. And
the same thing pertains to prejudice in every area, regardless of whether it's children or adults. There are explanations for adults too. These things don't appear in a vacuum or divorce from other relationships. I mean, this is patent. And if these kids exhibit prejudice, I think that we can try to understand it and try to correct it. But it is as virulent and as distasteful, and we want to get rid of it just as much as we do with an adult.
Yeah, well, that now that's an assumption that I don't know whether you were taught, whether you felt that I was going to draw that conclusion that you have a different attitude toward prejudice in children or not. But all I was saying was that before you come to any conclusions about a situation, you first examine it and see what it means.
From there, then you go on. Their perception and not our perception.
That's right. And it is true that every situation is a mixed situation. If you prejudice in adults, you can say the same thing about it. However, I think you have to say that in general, with adults in general and children in general, there often is a tendency to project onto the children the kind of thinking that adults have. And we found, as we went through these situations, we did find that was true. And then we had to stop and again look at the situation. Now, what one does about it is something that I haven't said anything about. I've simply made this first point that you need to recognize what the situation is. And also, you have to recognize that with young children, there may be a naive perception of differences which is not a prejudice. Now, a child doesn't... there was a time when people said, well, it's only when you get up to teenagers that you begin to really have prejudice. But we know that children at a very early age begin to reflect these attitudes of prejudice. I think that in the history of this whole thing, as far as the school is concerned, Dr. Kenneth Clark has been very helpful to us in helping to develop a philosophy, and I think his book, Prejudice in Your Child, is a very, very good one. He has spoke here on several occasions, and he made a point very strongly the very first time he came here to talk on this whole question of recognizing human beings. And this is perhaps an aspect of prejudice, that we in our thinking sometimes have a stereotype in our thinking so that we prejudge a situation in terms of these stereotypes. I can only give you a sort of a crude example of this in terms of camp situations where camp counselors who are with the best of intentions, I'm just thinking of an example now, of a Negro child, this white counselor, who started the diagnosing the situation. And immediately, without knowing anything about the situation at all, came to the conclusion, made a diagnosis which included the assumption that this Negro child lived in the slums and so on and so forth. I remember very well when Kenneth Clark spoke here and talked about teachers who will immediately, if a child is a Negro child, will immediately, if a Negro child is aggressive, they will immediately come to the conclusion that this child is aggressive because he's a Negro. We can have aggressive white children. We can have children very timid and shy, withdrawn white children, and we will presumably go to the variety of sources which make up the cause of this child's particular emotional situation. But when it comes to a Negro child, or any child of a minority group, we immediately make certain assumptions. And this, I think, is the kind of thing that is we point at when we say that the important first thing is to look at situations as objectively as possible and to look at human beings as human beings. come from homes where there are a variety of situations. There are parents, there are home situations, and there are common situations and common characteristics of all children. There are also certain aspects of problems which can be traced back to the fact that there exists a situation of prejudice.
Roman, yes, on that point, before you leave that, I think that that's an important point. I would like to speak a little bit on a corollary. And that is, and here there may be some disagreement, but that is, I feel that a person of a minority group who has the understanding about prejudice and realizes the difficulty surrounding it, the need for educating, the difficulty in overcoming it, has a, if he understands the situation properly, he has the extra duty of behaving better than the normal person in a particular situation. For example, I belong to a Y, the West Side Y up on 63rd Street for a number of years, and there was there were no Negroes there, and there were a number of us who tried to get Negroes into the place. We finally succeeded, and we had two Negroes admitted. And they looked like wonderful guys. And then an unfortunate situation developed. One of the Negroes was found with a white person in a homosexual relationship in the locker room at the Y. And immediately this put the damper on this whole fight that we had been struggling for. See, what do you expect? We told you so, etc. Since then, incidentally, this is a number of years ago, the attempt has been made again. The thing, there have been no unfortunate incidents, and more Negroes are members of that life. I'm thinking of Jackie Robinson particularly. It was fortunate for Negroes in baseball that it was a Jackie Robinson who was picked to be the first Negro, because he was a guy who, besides being a good ball player, was a very personable person, very bright, very sharp, and he endeared himself after the first 2 years when he took a lot of unfair and shameless ribbing. He endeared himself to the fans for the things that the fans liked besides his baseball ability. So it was a good thing that it was a Jackie Robinson. It might have been different, the struggle to put Negroes into baseball, if it hadn't been a Jackie Robinson who, personality-wise, was more glittering, more dramatic, more light than the average white player. So I hope I've made my point. I think that it becomes an extra duty of the need for a Negro or a Jew or any minority person who, when he's involved with others where prejudices do exist, to be on double guard.
May I add something, though? Now, you carry that one step farther, which a parent did with me within the week, in which she raised the question of the kind of Negro children we admitted to the school. And it seems that all the Negro children are the troublemakers. And consequently, what are we doing by bringing this kind of youngster into the school?
I think that these are actually several different kinds. These are two different problems. I think that there is no question about it that when a member of a minority group is in a situation and is maybe the sole representative, that that this person bears quite a burden. For the enlightened person who understands things, they have to this has to be understood. And it's unfortunate that there are situations like this where one person must bear this burden. The situation that Yuma is talking about is a situation which is very interesting because there are a number of Negro children in the school, and it is true, as I said, we have a parent body with many attitudes, and there may be a class where there may be three or four children whose behavior is disruptive. If in those three or four there is one Negro child whose behavior is disruptive, there is a tendency among such parents to hold that up. Even though there may be two or three other Negro children in the class, and that this kind of situation may be true, who are quite different. And this actually statistically has been the case. And I think that this is a manifestation of prejudice that we need to understand, and we have to cope with as part of our problem.
But well, I know it's not analogous.
Prejudice or questioning of something that exists. That's something that I'm not clear.
Well, say, in this class, there were, I would say, about four children that really, their behavior was out of line. There is among those four, perhaps one, perhaps two Negro children. But there are other Negro children in the class whose behavior is fine. Now, the parents who represent this attitude will single out a Negro child and say, look, this child, in the name of good relationships, we should not have this child in the school because we are harming intercultural relations. You see, in a school like this, it would be put in this way. We are harming intercultural relations by having a child like this in the school. Now, this is not, you see, this would be a manifestation of prejudice because it's a matter of prejudice, the word itself, of prejudging. It's a matter of judging the situation not in terms of reality, but in terms of one's emotions. Yes?
I agree that that's an ideal situation when the tantamount to a job in baseball. But it's not the minority group or the big minority group in a situation that is prejudiced. And it's not the minority group that's responsible for the prejudice either. I worked in a mill for a number of years, in a part of the mill that was by sort of collusion between the union and the management kept white. The rest of the open hearts, well, I won't say the rest of it, but a lot of the rest of it was mixed. But this one area was an area where you could start making a lot of money with very little experience. All you had to do was be strong, really, and learn physical skill. And it was held white. And one very persistent guy in our shop, the Negro guy, practically by himself, forced the union into a position of backing him for one of those jobs. And he came on the floor. And it changed the whole situation in the mill. Now, it meant that a lot of people were going to lose seniority on these good jobs. A lot of people were going to be bumped back. Because once it was opened up, he took his, you know, As soon as he moved on to the lowest job in this section, the next higher job that he was in line for, he could take in this section, and anybody else could come in and take his job. So it really opened up the whole floor, and a lot of people were not going to go up. They're going to stay on sort of semi-skilled jobs and not as high-paying jobs. And I don't know, I had an 8-hour argument, a whole shift, with a whole shift of white guys. The whole shift we argued, and it didn't seem to me that my job at that point was to argue with this one guy and tell him, you have to act particularly well. I had to argue with the rest of the guys that their position, one, was untenable, and it arose out of an injustice. You know, they were claiming justice on their side, because these people were going to go ahead of them. But it seems to me that the job isn't to make sure that the people who are going to get the new jobs, the Negro guys coming from the other parts of the mill, are going to be fine people. But the job is to force the rest of the guys into granting that there was an injustice and that it was prejudice and that they have to modify their position. And I think it ties in with what you said.
Because there was a white man involved in this homosexual act too.
Oh, sure. We know that.
I just want to back up with what Bob said. I feel that this is one of the reasons that there's so many pressures on Negro kids, because they're always, and they didn't start the prejudice, they're not the reason for the prejudice, but the pressure is always, you've got to do better, you've got to be this, you've got to be that. And I think of the line in Pearly Victorious, which I thought was terrific, when he said, you go to college to speak better. And this had a lot of meaning for me, because all through my life and in every situation I've been in, because you are a Negro, you must dress this way. Because you are a Negro, you must act this way. You must do this, you must do that. Where the burden is not on the Negro, as Bob says, it's on convincing these white people that hold the prejudice that it's not the Negro, but it's they're the ones that have to change it, because the Negro didn't make the situation. And just one more thing I'd like to say to that, and I think that the most important thing to me for in combating as far as the child is concerned, I'm not talking about the prejudice overall, but I mean the child's estimate of himself, is to help the child understand himself and his background, and that only through understanding, if he's a Negro child, his own culture and his own background, what he has given to this country, what he has given to the society, what his people have given, can this person become a secure person. And that this, you know, to me is what we strive to do with all children, regardless of their backgrounds, to make them proud of what they are. And that this is how they are prepared to face the prejudice. Not that they're going to eradicate the prejudice that way, it's going to, certainly not. But that this is how you think toward that child. As far as the other children are concerned, then again, it's not the Negro child that, or the, you know, the other Jewish child that has to prove himself. It's a situation that he was born into and didn't create.
No.
I think Bill had to pass that question.
When we opened this up, this, I think, was to understand more clearly what the philosophy of the school is with respect to intercultural and interracial education. And I will say now that I am in full agreement with Sam, with Bob, with Una, that the onus, the burden of responsibility should not be put on the person that is wrong to act any differently than the next person. Certainly when Langston Hughes had simple cry out, why can't he just be himself? Why does he have to be an example of something good? This has a lot of meaning here. But if we have a philosophy, and the philosophy implies that a deliberate attempt is made to arrive at certain goals, and to structure a thing so that we get certain results, then I think that we also have to wonder, for example, in my class, how do the white children feel
when they see day after day after day that every Negro child in that class, but this may just be an accident, does not function on the same level as they do. And of course, the Conway there also is that you would have some discipline problems to go along with it. And on the other hand, how do the Negro children feel when in the spirit of class discussion, day after day after day, they are a low man on the totem pole, and they know it. Now, I just throw this out for discussion. We have a philosophy. We want to inculcate in all of these children that people are people, that people are capable, people love, people are, that all these universal values are applicable to all people. But people being people, they see these things in terms of the way people function, even without prejudice.
But see, I think one of the things, Bill, is where you put your value and what contribution a youngster makes. Now, I don't happen to know your group at all, but I do know the eighth grade, and I'll give an illustration. Sam knows Pavlova, who came in as a very student with problems, academic problems, low achievement, and the emotional problems that accompanied that. Now, in this school, she got the security of being accepted, and she opened up. And I would say that Pavlova has probably made more of a contribution to our growth in understanding what America is like today than any other one child. She has described situations in Florida. She's very honest and discusses, she has seen a life that some of our protected white children have no idea of. She's exchanged these experiences with them. And this has, in turn, stimulated her desire to grow intellectually, and she will attain that too.
Let me just add one thing to that, and it's probably saying, in other words, what you would have said. That she has an intelligence that may not show up as high on an intelligence scale, but she has a wisdom about living which is perhaps beyond any child in that class. And if a teacher recognizes this and brings it into the life of the class, a child like this will get genuine acceptance and admiration for what she is. But I think that this still does not answer Bill's question, which is a crucial one, and I would like to discuss it. And it's a question put to the administrator, really, because I pass on admissions, so that it really is a question for me.
Before you go on to give your viewpoint, I would like to add one more thought on that. And that is my feeling, because my class has the same sort of representation that Bill speaks about. And I think that there is fault, I don't know whether it's the administration, but I think there's fault with the school in not having a representative Negro group in this school. I feel we don't have a representative Negro group. I feel we have a backward Negro group mostly represented here. We don't have sufficient of, at least it's been my experience, sufficient of the brighter Negro kids, and there are such.
Well, let me go on now to the administrator's point of view on this. I would say this first of all, that in the Negro community, Downtown Community School enjoys a very high reputation. There is a Negro parent, I don't even know her name, in the nursery school, in the kindergarten. This child is coming into the first grade. The other day told me, I didn't know this before, I think that all of you know who Kenneth Clark is. She said, I came here because Kenneth Clark told me that this is one of the few schools in the city that has the right attitude. Now, this could be duplicated everywhere in the Negro community. A school builds itself slowly. In terms of the history of private schools, we are a very young school. By and large, the enrollment in a school comes from parents. I don't care what you say about advertising and whatever you do, the bulk of enrollment comes from parents. And this, the school cannot control. Who applies, the school cannot control. If we had two lives, I could go out and do a lot of lecturing and reach a lot of people and get them into the school. But I'm generally about a month behind in all my own responsibilities. There is no one in the school that has the time to go out and do the kind of thing that might possibly bring in some enrollment. So that, by and large, the enrollment depends upon one parent recommending another. This is a way the reputation of the school has got around to Negro parents to the extent that we have a larger percentage of Negro children in our school than any private school in the city that I know of this type and of this standing. Now, as an administrator, I could have turned down every Negro child in that seventh grade, so that we had no Negro child in that seventh grade. The question is, would we be better off than we are now? You recall Bill did not say that there are no white children in the class who do not contribute on a low level. He said no Negro children. He didn't also say that there are perhaps as many white children in that class who come with some academic disabilities or some problem and also find it very difficult to contribute intellectually. Now, having discarded those Negro children who are in the situation, shall we also discard the white children in this situation and have a class of Leslie and Phillips White and Laurie? This is one solution. Now, let me go on a little bit farther. We have in this school a number of children, Negro children, of high intelligence. We had just graduated a class where half the children in the class were Negro and half white, where there was more leadership, dynamic leadership in the class among the Negro children than among the white children. These children in the class were not always like that. A large number of these children came in the seventh grade. And they came from schools where the academic situation was such that they came in with great difficulties. By the end of the eighth grade, these children were blossoming. And some of them didn't begin to blossom until they went to Seward Park, and now they're blossoming. But there are children in the present seventh grade, given another year in this school, that will match any white child in that class. Now, we have the situation. The problem that was faced by the Negro mother who says, shall I send my child into this situation with spitting children and white citizens' councils lining the road, or shall I wait till the educational situation is such that this child is going to have a happy time of it? The education that these children get, the one Negro child that goes into a school, don't think that this is a good education. We may have situations here which are not ideal educationally, but until a school does what we do and works through it, we are not going to have integration. And this kind of thing that is happening here can be happening elsewhere. Now you say, well, there must be Negro children that are from homes which are well-balanced, happy homes where the children are well-educated and so on and so forth. And we should find them. That's true. There must be white homes like that too, and we should find them. We should have a perfect student body here. But unfortunately, it's this way in life that it's often the parent whose child has been hurt by education, the Negro parent who wants to come here. Many of the middle class Negro parents in comfortable situations, because of our society, because this whole business of race is mixed up with status, will perhaps seek a school which gives them status. We have children who come from homes in the main where the parents are know their children are hurt, and they see their children going tortured in these situations day after day, and they come here because of that. And I think that we in looking at this, we have to look at take a large view of it and take it from this point of view. Now, there are no children in the school who are psychiatric problems. There are children here who Negro children who may have some problems of behavior, of aggression. We also have some white children like that. And I think that if we're going to achieve this, we will have to work through this situation and take the children we have and do the very best with them that we can. And I think that if these children were going out of the school at graduation the way they came into the school, I would say that this is true. But I think that we can point to what happens to them and say that that we are helping these children and making a contribution to integration.
Could I tell about Cal Grant now? For the new teachers, you don't know him, but here is an example of a youngster with great academic problems. And he was the low man on the totem pole, you know, in this group where there were so many Negro children. There were two or three right at the top of the class, too. In fact, one of the brightest girls academically was a Negro child. Now, Carol Grant struggled through this situation and grew in this school. And he went to the High School of Art and Design, and he rated the head of the class, the freshman class. Now, I think we have to see in this whole area of prejudice, here in my